What's up, everybody? My name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition, and you're tuned into Kinda Neat. Thank you guys for tuning in again. As always, first things first, please follow us on our social media outlets. You can follow me at It's Intuition. You can follow my man behind the boards, Ben Shim, making the shit sound buttery, at I Am Database, space with two S's. Facebook.com/kindaneat. Follow us on Twitter as a unit, at That's Kinda Neat. Just broke 500 Twitter followers on the same day that we broke 5,000 subscribers on YouTube, which brings me to say, please go check us out on YouTube, youtube.com/That's Kinda Neat. Thank you guys so much for all the views and stuff. Fucking, it just feels awesome. We've been doing it for about 7 or 8 months now. Things are going so swimmingly and we couldn't be happier. And of course, you can find everything at kindaneat.net wrapped up in a pretty package. I'm thinking I'm going to have to redesign the site soon too. So that'll be my New Year's project. Today on the show, I'm not going to talk too much because I feel like we're going to have a lot of new listeners with our guest today, Mr. Anthony Fantano. And I found that whenever I get a lot of new listeners coming to check a specific guest, they tend to think that I'm a douche when I do an intro. So I'm going to skip any douchey intros. And plus, our conversation runs a little long because Anthony's a talker. If you guys have seen his reviews, you know that man can talk. We had a great conversation about music and about his past and how he got to where he is. But yeah, so without much further ado, I'm just going to get right into the conversation. So here it is. Here's Anthony Fantano on Kinda Neat. What brings you out to Los Angeles?
What brings me out to Los Angeles is the YouTube Creator Camp, which I accepted an invite to. I think back in May, June, or July, and it's just sort of this 3-week camp, and we're in the middle of the second week right now. YouTube essentially flies us out to California, to Culver City.
Culver City, shout
and
out.
We hang out at the YouTube space in Culver City for a whole week, me and a few dozen other YouTube channels, all of which are of very different styles.
Yeah.
You know, there are some older ladies, some sweeter older ladies, middle-aged ladies.
What
that
do they do?
Arts and crafts. That do some knitting.
Okay.
Do some stitching and stuff like that.
Nice.
There's a younger girl that does crafts too.
Okay.
There's some makeup girls, some young makeup ladies.
Those are the ones you want to hang out with probably the
most. They hang out in their own little clique.
Yeah, yeah.
In the pretty girl clique.
Yeah.
Pretty girl mob, if they started a rap group.
Yeah.
Then there are some, you know, some sports guys, like some trick shot guys, some guys that do some trick shots.
Like basketball trick shots? Or
like, there's this one dude, his name is Brody Smith. He does some insane frisbee stuff.
Wow.
Like, super insane, accurate with the frisbee. Like, basketball hoop from 50 yards away sort of thing.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
So there's him and a few other guys that sort of do some sports, some trick shot stuff. There's some vloggers.
Are there any music dudes for you to nerd out with?
I'm the only music dude that I'm nerding out with. There are a few people there who have made like music parody videos and stuff like that, but I'm the only person who does like music reviews. But there are some other channels there too who are, they're the only channel doing what they do.
Right.
There's one girl who, I think she just had a birthday this week. She's in her 30s and she does an English pronunciation channel.
Wow.
Sort of helping people not only get a better grasp of the English language, but
she must
like,
love you
know,
because you're so well spoken.
She said that. She yeah. said that. And then there's one guy, he's 40, dad of 3, you know, married, lives in Northern California, works full time for Marvel in the animation department, and has a YouTube channel where he teaches kids how to draw.
That's tight.
And there's one guy who does skateboard tutorials, and he teaches kids how to skate.
Nice.
And there's another guy that does songs. He kind of does video game parody songs and stuff like that. And there are other channels, too, that are sort of, you know, one of a kind in the whole group. But, yeah, it's like a real mixed bag.
Is there anyone – I mean, I'm sure there are other people on YouTube reviewing records, but is there anyone with as much notoriety as you out there?
No. I mean, there are some other music channels that are pretty big. Like, there's one music channel called Brian Stars, and he just does interviews of bands. But, like, mostly bands that are, like, on Warped Tour.
Oh, okay.
Sort of a lot of pop punk stuff.
Yeah.
Things like that. But as far as artists that I'm covering and doing straight-up reviews, just sort of, like, one person on camera, that sort of thing, no. I mean, there's Noisy, and they have, like, 300,000 subscribers,
yeah.
maybe more. And then I think, like, the Pitchfork channel has like a few thousand more than me.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, as far as like other music channels that are covering a lot of the same artists I am. But I mean, as far as reviewing music, no. I mean, and but there are some other reviewer channels out there that, you know, I sort of I fucks with heavy.
Yeah.
Like Dead End Hip Hop. You know, who I was really getting into their stuff on the ground floor when one of their first reviews was like the Tyler, the Creator review for Goblin.
Okay.
And it was a fucking 4-part review, 15 minutes each video.
Wow.
And it's just like a round table of all four of them kind of going at this album. And, you know, it's really cool to sort of see I don't know if you're familiar with their channel.
I'm not.
I mean, it's four older dudes from Atlanta, you know, all of which are like, I think the youngest of them, the guy who does the camera work, he's like in his late 20s, I believe, but the rest of them are like in their 30s.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, just old hip hop heads. Some of them have more poppy tastes. There's one dude, his name is Mike, and he's kind of like the backpacker of the group. And, you know, while you can usually kind of predict how they'll feel about certain records because certain, you know, people in the group have certain tastes. It's really cool to all see their perceptions on a certain album and what about certain albums turns them on, turns them off. And, you know, and there are some artists like Eminem, for example. I'm kind of looking forward to their Eminem review because he's an artist who I can't really predict how all of them will react to him. I know a guy like Mike will dig him because he's always kind of been a fan, but there are some, you know, some sort of things unknown about what, you know, what they may or may not like. But yeah, I mean, I really like their channel. So I've been following that pretty closely and I've collaborated with them on a number of occasions. And there are some other YouTube channels too that do music reviews and do music related stuff that I've linked on my channel that I follow pretty closely. And yeah, I mean, as far as YouTube music stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was Needle Drop your first YouTube endeavor, or did you have any like tries and fails before it?
I had and still have a YouTube channel called That Is The Plan.
Mm-hmm.
That I would just sort of, that was like, you know, like you know, you have a YouTube channel that you just make because you want to subscribe to other YouTube channels.
Yeah.
You know, and occasionally I would put up a video where it's like me playing guitar or something. Like I have a few videos of their like old videos of me from like 2008 or something, like of me playing some acoustic covers.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't really doing anything on there other than that. I wasn't really expecting anything to come of the channel other than, you know, I just saw some other people doing some covers of artists that I wasn't really a huge fan of, like, you know, some popular artists and so on and so forth. And I was like, nobody on here has ever done like a Man cover or like a Mount Erie cover or something like that. So let me try doing that. And I remember around that time, I just bought an organ. And I remember after I purchased it, it was kind of like an impulse buy, you know, because I was working at a pizza place at the time and I just like had a lot of extra cash because I was just like getting paid under the table and they were paying me pretty well. And I just bought this organ and then I remember I just like didn't touch it and it was just like kind of sitting in my room and wasn't doing anything.
Like one of those electric organs that you find at a thrift store kind of?
Like it was a huge organ that I bought off Craigslist.
Oh, wow.
And I kept it in my bedroom and it was like taking up so much room that to leave the room, you would have to like walk sideways between the organ and the bed. Like that's how much room the organ took up.
Right.
And it was like one of those like two level organs,
oh,
you know,
yeah,
where
yeah.
you can have an effect up here and have an effect down there. And it also had a built in drum machine and it weighed a few hundred pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you needed like at least three people to move it.
Was it like free as long as you come pick it up type of thing?
I think I paid like $100 for it.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like on its last leg too, because I needed to like spray like some electronic like contact fluid like on there every once in a while just to like, you know, kind of keep the keys working.
Yeah.
I don't know why I didn't just like keep looking for organs, but I think part of the reason was is that I had been sort of searching Craigslist and I was kind of looking in a certain price range and I think I ran into like four or five organs that were just like garbage.
Right.
Or like there were a few keys missing or broken or something.
So I was like, you better swoop on this one.
So this was like the first organ that like it was completely working and it just was really huge. So, I mean, I got it. And then this Man record came out called Rabbit Habits that I wasn't like really that I'm not really huge on now. I loved it when it first came out, but I kind of grew cold on it over the years. But I mean, it inspired me to actually get behind the organ because it was just an album that had a lot of organ on it that with songs that I liked. So I said, okay, so let's like try to play these songs. And I remember putting up like 3 or 4 videos on YouTube of me covering some of those songs from their record and maybe their previous record too. But I think I remember after the first one, despite the fact that after having learned like 5 of their songs, I realized that some of the chords I was playing on the first cover I did of theirs was wrong because I was trying to teach myself purely by ear.
Yeah.
Which is something I'm not unfamiliar with given that, you know, before that I already knew how to play bass and I already knew how to play guitar and, you know, with some of the punk music that I was huge into, it's not like, you know, you could learn how to teach yourself some of these 80s hardcore songs or anything like that. It's not like there's a music book for any of them.
Right.
And I wasn't really finding a lot of tabs for them online either.
Right.
So I was just sort of like doing all that by ear. But I had never tried to teach myself piano or organ or anything. But I remembered after learning the 5th track of theirs, I was like, man, I fucked those chords up. That's totally wrong. But still, after I made that song, I ended up getting a comment from the guy who fronts the band, and he's like, great job, bro.
No shit.
And then I remember like 24 hours later, he put up a video on his YouTube channel of like him playing the song, but like in the shadows. And he's like, and he wrote in the description, doing a really shitty cover of this Man song, da 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 da. It's like, I hope it came out okay. And, you know, and it's obviously him, you know, but he like put it as a response to my video, which was pretty hilarious.
That is funny.
So on there, I have like some videos of that. Then I have like a few videos of this duo that I was in for a while. I played bass in the duo, and the guy who I played with played drums, and he was this older gentleman who was old enough to be my dad, but he was like this amazing drummer.
What kind of stuff were you guys playing?
We were playing like drone metal.
Okay.
Like, you know, I had like some delay pedals and some loop pedals and stuff like that. And we, it was like kind of a financial endeavor on both our parts because I spent all this money on these 1000 watt bass cabinets and, from this like independent company, like in the Midwest or something.
Uh-huh.
And he ended up buying a 2000 watt amplifier so that we could have this massive, this really deafening sound when we played. And, we ended up, he's like I said, a fantastic drummer, and he, had a lot of connections in the New Haven music scene because one thing that's big in New Haven is singer-songwriter music. And, you know, at least during the time that we were playing, and, he was known for playing on a lot of the records down there for some people there. So he had connections at some certain venues and with some certain people, and they'd be able to get us some shows. And, you know, we played a handful of shows in New Haven, and we were never invited back to anywhere.
Why?
Because it was not, you don't want to be playing drone metal in New Haven.
Yeah.
It's the last place you want to be playing drone metal, especially a band that's unknown and a drone metal band.
And so you guys are like opening for singer-songwriters or something, but playing drone metal?
We were opening for a few harder rock bands and stuff like that. We were on some mixed bills of other smaller groups that, you know, were still also kind of being tested out.
Yeah.
The one place where we played, after a while, we just weren't playing anymore. And we were just like trying to write songs, and we were thinking about recording music, and we tried to record our album a few times, but each time we just like weren't connecting with a producer who was familiar with the music that we were listening to and sort of familiar with the kind of bass and heaviness and the wall of sound that we were shooting for. Because a lot of the producers in the area are also working with the singer-songwriter types and folk rock types and stuff like that. And, you know, I think we were on the cusp of wanting to go down to New York. He had a connection with this guy, Colin Marston, who's this really good metal producer, and he's also a metal player in a lot of different bands that I'm a fan of. And I think I just ended up not being into the idea because I was so frustrated with the idea that we were like trying to record this music, and like every time that we've tried so far, like the person who we've worked with doesn't understand, and I didn't want to shell out more money and just like, because I had very little money to begin with. Because this is even before the needle drop was like a successful thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, I just like didn't have much money to play with. And it's like, I didn't want to go down to New York and like just spend all that time down there.
When did you start picking up instruments?
I started playing bass at 13.
Mm-hmm.
So
what drew you into it?
What drew me into bass? I wanted to play some instrument, you know, and somebody had recommended that I just try bass because it's an instrument that not a lot of people try to play, and as a result, it might get me to play with more people.
Right.
But what was really funny is I think getting into punk music and being the only person who played instruments being into punk music at my school, or at least, you know, hardcore punk music, it was actually like the opposite, because I didn't want to play with anybody because it's like I just want to play punk music.
Yeah.
So this drummer friend of mine who I was playing with, I think the only place we were ever invited back to was in Waterbury, this metal venue that some friends of mine were running. And some of that really guttural metalcore that I was telling you about in the car, because as people don't know, we were talking about some music.
We had a fucking hour and a half drive to get here during rush hour.
We had some pre-convo in the car, and we were talking about the Connecticut music scene, the illustrious, world-famous Connecticut music scene. And I was talking about how metalcore was big over there, especially when a band like Hatebreed was at their zenith. I use that word. And there are still a lot of kids that hang around that are into that shit, you know, and are, you know, sort of into nu metal too. And, you know, it didn't really strike me at the time to be a place to play because, like, you know, you want to try to play in New Haven because New Haven is the hippest place in Connecticut to play. Uh-huh. And if you have a lot of people going to your shows in New Haven, you must be doing right. You must be doing something right, I guess. But we ended up playing at this Waterbury venue, and all these metalheads who had never heard drone metal before just loved what we were doing because of how loud and heavy it was. You know what I mean? And we were playing like before all these bands that were like, djun, 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 you know, and stuff like that, and doing breakdowns and so on and so forth. And then, you know, while we weren't doing, you know, just a straightforward technical breakdown, to be playing slow, heavy, loud, riff-oriented music, it was actually really funny. Like, you had kids like in this packed place at this Battle of the Bands, and we went on last. And it was funny. The stipulation of the Battle of the Bands was that because they had like 20 bands on, it was like an all day thing. They said that if you left, you forfeited the Battle of the Bands. And the way that they decided who won was that you needed your fans there to vote and raise their hands. Mm. So we had a captive audience and nobody knew who the hell we were. Mm. And we went on final, and kids were like slow motion moshing inside, like on the floor. Yeah. They're like, this sounds like we could mosh to it, but it's so slow. So yeah. They're just like, I had to like stop looking at the crowd because I was like laughing and getting distracted, like, at what was going on, because people were just like, and just like slow motion spin kicking.
It just looks like Neo in the Matrix and shit.
Yes. And I was just like, oh my God.
That's great.
Like so weird.
So are you singing too?
No.
In your cover videos, are you singing?
In the cover videos, singing, yeah. But I mean, a lot of them I would sort of like cut my head off and everything because it's like I just wanted it to be about a song or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's funny, like, I also—
because you wanted to accentuate your sexy body in the video.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you for that. I also put videos on that channel now, sort of like contests and stuff like that.
Okay.
Like, hey, you could win this vinyl because I just have this vinyl lying around. And
right.
It's funny because people go back and they see some of those old videos and they're like, oh, what is this? Like, this is crazy. What's going on here, Fantano? I didn't know you were playing guitar. What's going on with this?
Right.
But there are some videos up there too of me and my drummer friend playing, because he would like insist that we always tape our shows.
Okay.
He was like, he was one of those people that was like, you know, he's like a serious eccentric. And like, you know, was really like serious about everything that we were doing, and, you know, would like, I would have to like stop him from like saying some stuff sometimes, you know, and, you know, it was stuff that like would worry me, but it was also stuff that I would like love him for. Like, we would play because, you know, we were like such fringy sort of, you know, sound.
Yeah.
We would like, you know, end up playing like these very bottom of the barrel gigs. Like, we ended up playing with this group of people who, they were all like long haired, long beards, and they were like playing this weird freaky folk, and the kid was singing like at the front of the thing with this broken guitar, and there was a guy who was playing an upright bass who was like in his 50s and wearing like a tie-dye shirt, and the kid was singing like the most obnoxious way possible.
Uh-huh.
It was like this really obnoxious freak folk. And I remember my drummer was talking with the bass player before they went on. They're like, he said, hey, your music's pretty weird. And he says, but our music's weirder. And he said it as a joke, you know.
Yeah.
He's like nudging him. And my drummer took it serious. And he's like, oh yeah, you think it's fucking... you know, da, 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 you think it's fucking
you
weird,
it
we'll show
challenge.
You weird, you
yeah.
know? And then I'm just like, don't, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, he's just fucking around. It's okay.
That's fine.
But, you know, he took how out there some of our stuff was very seriously because, you know, he really wanted to do something different, as did I.
Right.
But, yeah, you know, the kind of like what we were also talking about in the car, you know, if you want to do something completely wild and different, Connecticut's not really a place to do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like,
what's it like growing up in Connecticut as a kid?
I mean, it's like Connecticut's a place where, like, you know, they talk about how hard hitting of a place some states or cities can be. And the thing is, like, Connecticut is just as grimy as any other place in a lot of spots, uh-huh. you know. But the thing is like, you know, most people are like so poor and destitute that they wouldn't like have the money to make music,
uh-huh.
you know, anything, at least anything like that would be like, you know, hip hop, for example, like you wouldn't like in Connecticut have some like really grimy ass street shit like going on in Connecticut because rent is so high and instruments are so few. We don't have a lot of music stores and stuff like that. And the ones that we do are more like rock based and stuff. And while there are some suburban parts and there are some like, you know, grimier spots, and I've sort of grown up a little bit in few with my parents having been divorced and, you know, mom moving around a lot, but my dad staying in one spot. Grew up in West Haven, which was like a pretty close knit area with like a lot of Italian families and stuff like that. But then later down the road, like living in like a really crappy apartment building, like in Naugatuck with like some, you know, some drug addicts there and so on and so forth. And then like moving up to Bristol, which was like kind of a nicer spot, but like, you know, like some troubled families there too. But then eventually my mom got a house in Woolkit, but all the while, like my father was staying in a more suburban area and I was kind of going in the school district over there. So it was like kind of being between these two spots and like, you know, growing up with a lot of kids from different racial backgrounds and different like, you know, ethnic and financial backgrounds too.
So you had a diverse experience there.
I mean, yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, more than I think a lot of people would assume and more than I think a lot of people in Connecticut do because, you know, there are some very, very rich towns out there where, you know, a lot of people who live in those towns don't really have a lot of like racial misconceptions and so on and so forth because they don't really hang about with anybody who's not white.
Right.
And a lot of people say things about Connecticut because of how rich some areas are. But I mean, I don't know. I don't have the statistics on this. But if there was a state out there that had a greater financial divide or the greatest financial divide, I would say it would have to be Connecticut, given that there are people that live in the state that, you know, are in the 1% of people
there
living
like
in America.
Super rich and the super poor there.
Yeah. You know, but then, you know, there are people who, I remember when my girlfriend and I just moved into an apartment 2 years ago or like over just over a year and a half ago. And we were looking at a lot of different areas. We were trying to stay in the same area that we were. She's from Meriden, which is another kind of place where you have some suburban areas, but then you have like some spots where, you know, that are really seedy. But we were looking in an area called Waterbury where, you know, my friend and I were playing. We were just like looking at some Craigslist rentals and stuff like that. And, you know, we were like driving through spots with boarded up houses and everything and like mattresses out like on the side of the road and like, you know, cars piled up on top of each other parking on the street. It's like, you know,
it's like Detroit or something.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and it's like there are kids like running around and like most of the houses look like they're just must be condemned, you know, at least in some sort of way. And there are spots like that in that Waterbury area where like you can't get like a really nice place to live. And if you can, because of how corrupt the politics have been over there for so long, like the taxes are insanely high, like way higher than they should be for a place like that,
right.
You know, in terms of like property value, you know.
You said your parents split up. What age was that at? You got brothers and sisters?
I have one brother who's 4 years younger than me. I think I was about 6 or 7 when they split up.
Oh, so pretty young.
It was pretty young, and when it happened, it was pretty fast.
What did your folks do? What did your dad do?
My dad did a lot of things. My mother's always kind of been an accountant.
Okay.
And, you know, has done that, and I was actually going to be doing that. It was like kind of one of my possible career paths in college, and she's not the only accountant in my family either. And so I had studied that for a little while, but my dad was kind of like a jack of all blue collar trades. Like he did a lot of metal work and welding. He worked over at the shipping warehouse doing a lot of facilities stuff for Stop and Shop, which is essentially like one of the largest grocery chains in the New England area. It's now owned by like some Swedish company, but like when I was a kid, it was like a local company. Mm-hmm. And he worked in a warehouse over there. He owned a few gyms over the course of when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember whether or not he owned two or three gyms. But either way, you know, he always had me as a kid in the gyms because that was like his job. You know, he built some of the equipment there, especially more so in the second gym that I remember him owning when I was older. He ended up having to close the first gym down, you know, as well as the next one because it wasn't making money. And it was partially because, you know, me a lot like him, you know, you have kind of a belief in a way and a way in your head as to how things should work. And you're very hardline about that. And you're very stubborn about that. And you want it to work that way. And while, you know, gyms can serve a myriad of different purposes and health lifestyles, he was very into powerlifting and, you know, just pretty much wanted to cater to that sort of crowd.
So dad's a big dude then.
Dad's a big dude. Yeah. Dad's like well over 300 pounds at this point.
No shit.
Dad was over like 400 at another point and trained a lot of other big dudes, you know, and bodybuilders too, you know, people who just wanted for the cut look, you know, and train people for competition too.
Wow. Are you a weightlifter?
I mean, you know, everything that I learned from him, you know, I mean, it was never anything I pursued on a competitive level, but right. I mean, it's like, you know, I was a kid and I was with him for the day and I was 12, 13, 14, 15. And, you know, it's like, there's nothing to do at the gym, but lift weights. So it's like, why not?
Yeah. I mean, you're built like a brick shit house, man. You're a big boy.
So, you know, so he just had me like lifting weights because it was fine to do. I mean, there wasn't anything to do at the gym. I mean, I was at the gym after school, you know, until like 5, 6, 7, 8 o'clock and whenever it would close. And it was playing gym. It was lifting weights, eating chicken cutlet sandwiches, and playing video games. Yeah. And that was pretty much it.
Why was mom moving around so much, you said? Like just different jobs, take her to different places?
It was different jobs and just wanting to move into a better place. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like where we used to live in Naugatuck was like not a nice place. Mm-hmm. And then in Bristol, I mean, it was fine and it was safe, but we had like crazy neighbors. You know, we had like one year we had all of these college kids that like partied so hard and it was like noisy all the time. And like, you know, they would spill kegs and like beer would like come down in the ceiling. Ugh. And then like, you know, another year after that, we had like couples that would like fight angrily and really loudly all the time. And just like in this unapologetically like loud, we don't give a shit if anybody hears us kind of way.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then, from there, you know, eventually we moved into Wolcott, which was like the suburban town, which was fine. And, it just so happened that the town that my dad was living in doesn't have a high school and that all the kids from that town actually ended up getting shipped over to Wolcott to do school.
Okay.
So I would have ended up going to that school anyway.
So was it a pretty even like 50-50 split with the parents or did you stay with more one than the other?
It was even split. Yeah.
And they've always remained civil and shit.
I mean, for the most part, I mean, when it comes to the kids, you know, as far as like sharing the kids and everything. Yeah. I mean, they never really got along and they don't really like speak or anything like that. You know, and when they do, it's not like pretty.
Right.
But everything's cool in terms of like, I didn't ever feel like I never got to see my dad. You know, I saw my dad a lot.
Right.
As did my brother.
What's your brother like? Do you guys share a lot of similar interests or are you guys opposites?
I mean, we do and we don't. I mean, I think we're opposites in terms of just like our energy level and just like our drive. My brother is much, much, much more chill than I am. Whereas I'm like super hard work, super this, super that. But you know, it's like, I feel like while that gets me places, sometimes I make myself crazy.
Yeah.
Whereas he's just like so much more relaxed.
You find it hard to relax sometimes?
I mean,
Do you feel like a piece of shit when you're not doing something?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of the time. Yeah, actually. But the thing is not only do I feel like a piece of shit sometimes when I'm not doing something, but like even when I'm just chilling and doing nothing, it's like my head is just thinking and thinking and thinking and thinking and thinking. You know, it's like it's hard to just like shut it off because it's going a million miles a minute.
Yeah. So you're a workaholic?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. Does that affect the relationship at all or what?
With my girlfriend?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Oh, like it has before. You know, but the thing is like as much as I'm like a workaholic, my girlfriend's a bit of a workaholic too.
That's cool.
You know, I mean, it's just like a workaholic of a different, you know, because she's doing more of like 9-to-5 kind of corporate ladder sort of thing.
Right.
Which is like, that's fine, you know, if that's what you want to do. But I mean, you know, and not that that doesn't come with its challenges, but I mean, at least for me, I need like kind of a personal challenge that I set myself out on.
Yeah.
Or else, like, I just kind of go crazy.
Are your parents both really bright, too?
I mean, I guess in their own certain ways. I mean, you know, when it comes to, like, weightlifting and powerlifting, my dad is, like, a borderline genius.
Yeah.
You know,
your dad sounds like a real man's man.
I mean, like, he is, you know, to a degree, but, like, you know, he's always been, like, he's never, like, pushed my brother and me to be, like, super macho or anything like that, you know? He's always been pretty cool with whatever we wanted to do or whatever we wanted to, you know, sort of pursue or whatever our passion was or whatever. You know, he never made us felt like we weren't being, like, guys or anything like that. But in terms of, like, the whole powerlifting thing, I mean, it's like, you know, he's had pages and books about powerlifting written about him. And, you know, people who are of a certain era in powerlifting, like, know his techniques and, you know, there are certain people who have trained with him who have gotten really famous and sort of have went on to train other people. But the thing about powerlifting and, you know, bodybuilding in general is that, like, the people who to be in your peak condition, you know, and everything like that, it's just like a really small window in your life. You know what I mean? It's like you can't powerlift with the same longevity that you can play basketball
or
like, you know, play another sport where, you know, even more people are watching you. So it's like not only is it difficult to make a really long lasting and famous name for yourself because it's such an unpopular sport, but it's also the fact that you only have so many years to kind of like make it happen.
Right.
You know what I mean? And the fact that he, you know, in terms of like starting a weightlifting franchise, you're pretty much in a smaller market. You know, there's not a big market for anything in Connecticut, maybe like foodie shit, you know, and like stuff like that, you know, Martha's Vineyard type stuff. But I mean, in terms of like weightlifting and bodybuilding, it's not exactly like Connecticut is a hot spot. And my mother, you know, is bright in that. I mean, she's definitely the workaholic, you know, and I kind of feel like I got that just like I have a passion for something and I just like want to, you know, and I only care about that and I only want to
drill through it
with that, you know, like my father does, but kind of like I have that drive to work like my mother does. And
as a kid, was it did it get picked up on pretty early that you're like I would imagine that you were like magnet or GT or like gifted pretty early on and it must have been recognized?
No.
Not good in school?
Nobody really said I was bright as a kid, and I didn't even really think I was bright as a kid either. I didn't think I was bright either. My grades were always pretty like B plus, B minus. I was never like an A plus kind of kid. I thought school was boring a lot of the time. But I mean, but my dad was always like, if there was one thing that my dad was ever stern about, it was getting good grades. And my dad was like fine with me getting B's and everything. So I just kind of like maintained at that level.
I find that so surprising because just because like, I'm sure you get told this every fucking day, but you're so well spoken and like never stumble or anything. You just sound smart as a fucking whip. You know what I mean?
I mean, like I said, I was never like crazy, crazy, insane, like in love with school. I mean, I think like the one thing in like the few things in school that I liked was like math. You know, I liked math and I liked the idea of history and stuff like that. But I always felt the things that we learned about were boring. I mean, I like I have this vivid memory of like being in like very early grade school and having a conversation with the teacher and like being upset that we learned American history last year and that this year we weren't learning Chinese history. And I remember
history is very biased in American schools.
And, you know, it wasn't even that. As a kid, I wasn't like, I feel like American history is biased or anything that. I was just upset because I wasn't like, we learned American history last year. Why do we got to do it again? Let's like learn some Chinese history. You know, it's like what happened in China. And then my teacher, I remember my teacher just said, well, we live in America, so we learn American history, which is just like, ugh, why?
You're like boring.
You know, and it's like, and of course, like, you know, what's American history in first grade is different than what's American history when you're a senior in high school. But I remember in the next grade, it was like the same thing to me. You know, I was just like, I just wanted something different.
Where does this passion for music come from? Were your parents into it?
My mom and my dad were never really huge, huge into music. Like there's not like a music nerd in my family. My father will tell you himself that like, even songs from like his childhood, he's like, a lot of it sounds the same to me and I can't name you songs and on and so forth. Like the, one of the few people that like my dad is passionate about musically is like Elvis Presley. And then there is this one lady, her name is, what is it? Clary Brown and the Bangin' Rackets. And they have this one song called, I can't remember the name of the fucking track, but the song has a music video and it, it's like shot in a jailhouse. And the thing about Clary Brown is that me personally, I think she's just like an Amy Winehouse knockoff.
Okay.
You know, but the thing is my father just hears this song, I think in a commercial or something, and he like loves it and he buys the CD and he thinks it's like the greatest thing ever. And,
oh, so this is something new.
Yeah, this is something new. Oh, okay, this is okay. Not, this is like the one new artist that I've ever seen my father enjoy.
Okay.
And the thing is like, I'll try to turn him on to stuff. Like I'll like hear stuff like, you know, old rock and roll shit, like Sun Records stuff, like, you know, because there was a while where I was heavy into like blues and old school like 50s era R&B, trying to get him into that. But all he really cared about was Elvis, you know. And not that Elvis isn't an artist worth caring about and not that he wasn't a unique artist. But, you know, I guess my father has a lot of brand loyalty, you know, when it comes to music.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah. And, you know, my mom, I mean, you know, she loved music as a kid and she speaks really fondly of the artists that she grew up with. But, you know, I wouldn't say she was an expert on any of them. She never really played an instrument or anything or had the drive to learn an instrument really proficiently. I mean, I think maybe what was the best thing about and not that my dad was ever a person who was like, you shouldn't listen to this, you know, because I mean, there were moments where if I was in the car with my dad and I was trying to put in a CD or something, he'd fucking throw it the fuck out. And
oh,
like,
really?
Get out of here.
Yeah.
You know, but if I'm listening to it on my stereo, he was fine with it.
Right.
But I mean, at least, you know, my mother was really open to whatever I wanted to listen to. And she was very interested in whatever I wanted to listen to. And I remember like as a kid, another thing we were talking about was like nu metal and stuff. And, you know, there were some nu metal bands that I liked. And I remember like, you know, like when Rammstein came out, though not technically a nu metal band, but
the
like when Rammstein came out, like, that Duhas song, like I loved that song when it first came out and I was a kid, but my mom was like, that's a good song.
The first time I heard that song and saw that video, I was so stoned and it came on MTV and I was just like, what is happening right now? It was so weird to see a German metal song on fucking MTV. It was
on MTV.
Strange.
And as far as my weirded out MTV moments, I remember not stoned though, because I was probably just 4 years younger than you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I remember like having nightmares after watching the Nine Inch Nails video for Closer.
Oh God.
I was like,
that video. Was very,
when
creepy.
I was a kid, that was like the most fucked up thing I'd ever seen. But anyway,
I mean, was getting into music almost seems like a form of a quiet form of rebellion or something. Like, you know, my parents aren't into this. Maybe this will be my thing. I don't know.
I never had a moment in my life where I felt like I wasn't allowed to listen to something.
Right.
You know, I mean, even tracks that like, you know, sometimes I'll go back and I'll listen to stuff that I used to listen to as a kid. And I'm like, I'm surprised my mom let me listen to this, know, because, you know, it was like Marilyn Manson and shit like that.
Yeah.
Actually, like the first band I ever got super, super, super obsessed with was Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah, that was one of my early ones too. My dad's friend, Aaron, gave me a – shout out to Aaron Boyle. He gave me a tape of theirs when I was in sixth grade. And I remember distinctly – like actually he told me, don't tell your parents I gave you this. And
really?
I'm like – yeah, Rage Against the Machine was a huge early influence on me.
You know, like I remember, I was always into, I was super into stuff that I heard on the radio. But then I remember like when I was a kid, I guess the only maybe moment of tension in regards to music was like, I remember for a few years or maybe it just felt like a few years when I was a kid. Maybe it was just a year because it happened during Christmas. It finally occurred during Christmas. But I think I remember all year just like begging my mom for a boombox because – you know, I just wanted something that I could listen to the radio on and sort of play tapes on and stuff. And I think what made me want a boombox was like this really funny clip. You remember that show, Salute Your Shorts?
Dude, I just tweeted about Salute Your Shorts yesterday.
There's this episode of Salute Your Shorts that I cannot find on YouTube.
Yeah.
Actually, the first half of it is on YouTube. And I think the episode cuts off before this part occurs. But there is this part in this episode that just sort of like burned itself into my psyche and just like made me want a boombox, you know? And just to like, you know, play your music and listen to your music. And then I remember like first tapes I got, Evil Empire was like the first tape that I got.
Yeah.
And then I remember I was like, that's when Green Day did Dookie too. So it was like, I like Dookie. That's
Dookie was so huge when it came out, man.
Dookie was huge. Offspring was huge too.
Yeah.
Got Offspring. Actually, my mom loved Offspring.
Yeah.
She liked Gotta Keep Them Separated.
Yeah.
She thought that was like the best song ever. she would like always repeat that chorus.
I've told this story before, but at a junior high like dance, there was like a dance competition, and I was one of the only people that entered, so I won, and I won two tapes, and one of them was The Offspring, and the other one was Keith Murray, The Most Beautifulest Thing, and I still have those tapes to this day. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like totally into rap then, and I wouldn't have given The Offspring a chance, but because I won that tape, I actually got into Offspring, and I liked that tape a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you know, once you like really get into punk music, you know, you sort of look back on The Offspring as like kind of this ew moment, but the thing is like, I have a soft spot at least for those few tracks.
Yeah.
You know?
My dad actually, one of the things that probably got me into music as a kid was my dad was super into music, had a huge vinyl collection, and was never very musical. He played a little bit of saxophone, but wasn't like in bands or anything. But he always had a subscription to Rolling Stone. Like ever since I was a child, we have stacks upon stacks of Rolling Stone. And so I remember actually reading when the Offspring tape came out, like they had a big article in Rolling Stone about it. And the next month in the letters to the editors, one of the fans was like, oh, fucking calling The Offspring punk rock is bullshit. Like that guy's got a PhD. Like he's doing for punk rock what fucking, you know, so-and-so is doing for this and like this backlash. And that's when I was like, oh, punk, I should look more into punk rock because this sounds cool. If this guy thinks these guys are fucking dorks, then there's probably some really cool shit out there, you know? So yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I was huge into Offspring and I had some like poppier tapes too. I mean, I had a Bush tape, had a Red Hot Chili Peppers tape.
That first Bush album's good.
I had the 16 Stone was the one that
I had. Yeah, the one with like Come Down on it and stuff like that.
Machine Head.
Yeah, Machine Head. Yeah.
So I had that one. And I had like, I think I had Crazy Sexy Cool too.
Okay.
I had that TLC tape.
Yeah, shout out to Left
Hand. I had that one. I had Coolio. I had Coolio tape.
Of course.
Coolio because fucking Gangster's Paradise was the jam.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
That was right around the time that Regulators came out. The Above the Rim soundtrack was a big one right around then.
There was that. And what else did I have a tape of? I mean, I just had a bunch of tapes, but then I remember, I think, and then there was something that like almost destroyed my passion for music.
What was that?
Weird Al's Bad Hair Day.
Oh, fun fact. Weird Al is my very first concert I ever went to in eighth grade.
Really?
Our GT teacher took us to see Weird Al.
Weird Al. Actually, like I listened to Weird Al obsessively at that point. And then I remembered I listened to that tape for months on end to the point where I had worn the tape down to the point where all the songs sounded funny.
Yeah.
And because I was just constantly just like fast forwarding and rewinding parts and stuff like that. And like
that was
to the
album with like the Jurassic Park song on it. And
that
stuff
was the
like
album
that?
Where the Coolio cover.
Oh, okay.
Had,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
The, yeah. And everything. Amish Paradise.
Amish Paradise.
And then after that tape came out, I felt like I couldn't take music seriously anymore.
Because he had lampooned it so hard? Because
he had lampooned it so hard. Yeah. And it's like, I was just like, man, music's just this one big joke now.
Yeah.
And then and then around that time, that's also when like CDs started to sort of come on the come up.
Yeah.
And I think I kind of took a break from music for a little while. And then I remember a handful of years going by and not really following music too closely, because I think what also happened in addition to all of that is that my boombox broke. I think I busted my boombox.
Yeah, and you know I can't live without my radio.
Exactly. So I mean, literally, music world just shut off for me, you know, outside of what was like going on in the car. And then I think like a handful of years later, like my mom ended up getting remarried, and this was around a time when like they were having those handouts go out that was like, get 16 CDs for a penny.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the little catalogs.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like I remember my stepsisters, my brother and I were all like allowed to pick four CDs each between the four of us.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I remember just like seeing all these CDs in there that I had no clue what the fuck they were. And I think like out of some of the CDs that we ended up getting picked up, of course I got a fresh copy of Rage Against the Machine's Evil Empire.
Yeah.
Because that was like, you know, I couldn't play the tape anymore.
Yeah.
That was like the first thing I was like, oh, that.
Yeah.
You know, that's the shit.
That was the Yellow album, right? That was their second album?
That was the album that got Grammy nominated.
Yeah, yeah. That was a big one. I remember that.
Bulls on Parade on that
Bulls
thing.
On Parade. I think I've maybe told the story, but I was on a baseball trip my freshman year of high school, and I remember like being on the trip and staying up late because MTV was going to premiere the video at midnight.
Really?
We had a game the next morning at 8 a.m., and we were supposed to be in bed asleep, but I stayed up and just to see the Bulls on Parade premiere, and it was like a real life changer.
Really?
Yeah, oh yeah. That was a big album when it came out.
That was like one of my favorite. So that's still one of my favorite songs ever.
And the thing is, like I said, I got put onto them in sixth grade, and as a sixth grader, in it, like quietly in my bedroom, singing like, you know, fight the war, fuck the lords. Like, oh man, this is like my rebellious shit. You know what I mean? That was amazing. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how so many people sort of like. I mean, I always have seen music as kind of like a point of rebellion, but like because my parents were never like on my ass about whatever I listened to, yeah. I just saw it as sort of like a moment of rebellion against the world at large.
Right.
You know, I mean, it was kind of like a rebellious thing to me because I knew what I was listening to, especially when I got into punk music, was something that wasn't popular and was saying things that most people didn't believe in and was putting out messages that I agreed with ideologically, but most people didn't. Realize,
right?
You know?
Yeah, as we spoke in the car, you said you went through a really heavy punk phase while you were in what
high school.
So, did you kind of see yourself as an outsider while you were in high school? Is that what drew you to the music?
I saw myself as an outsider in high school. I was really fat and heavy as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my father's fat and heavy. My brother was fat and heavy too. A lot of people are heavy set on my father's side of the family. And not that I think pushed me to listen to a different kind of music because I mean, you know, I just liked what I liked and, you know, when I listened to Rage Against the Machine, I didn't really talk music with other – I mean, you know, you're talking about like being 9, 10, 11, 12.
Right.
And that's not really a moment where I feel like music defines cliques in school.
Absolutely.
Or anything
yeah,
like
not
that.
Yet.
You know, so it's – music wasn't really something I talked with other kids at school about, and it's not really something other people asked me about. So it wasn't until high school where it kind of felt like – I'm listening to different things than other people. But I mean, at that point I already kind of felt like an outsider going into school, not because of what I was listening to, but just because other people thought I was fat and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And, you know, that alone sort of, you know, in a time when childhood obesity wasn't like the norm,
right.
You know, like being the only fat kid in school. But, yeah, when I got into high school, I got into like nu metal stuff like Marilyn Manson and Slipknot, and that was mostly through other people who, you know, were sort of at the rock kids table.
Yeah.
You know, because out of everybody who was there, that was pretty much all who I identified with off the bat.
Yeah.
And that's what they were listening to. You know, they were listening to Korn. They were listening to
Limp Bizkit.
But also, you know, around that time too is like when I started checking out TRL and that sort of thing, like after school. Like if I wasn't watching like whatever cartoons were on, I was watching TRL.
The Deftones?
I, you know, honestly, never got huge into the Deftones. As much as I remember their songs on the radio, there are certain groups that, like, I feel like in retrospect had much better discographies than some of the groups that I was into, but I just – they never ended up clicking with me.
Deftones actually aged pretty well too. Like
they did.
Some of their back catalog going back and it's like you're like, oh, wait. I don't know why these guys got bunched in with Limp Bizkit because they're a lot better than that, I think.
Yeah. I mean it's like, you know, they had some of the similar sounds and everything like that. But it's like that, you know, Tool is an example too.
Oh, Tool's a band, great.
Tool's a band that I heard when I was a kid, but honestly never fucking owned an album of theirs.
Yeah.
But talking about different personalities, my brother actually clicked with Tool.
Yeah.
And he ended up getting opiate and enema or anemia and 1,000 days. No, Lateralis, because 1,000 days came out. 10,000 days came out after that. And Lateralis. And then I ended up actually appreciating them through him because they were a group that clicked with him versus me.
Yeah.
I was much more, and I think this is why, you know, Deftones and Tool, they're just like while they do have hard rock sounds sometimes, they're just much more chill. They're much more sort of like subtle, you know? And when I was a kid, I just like
you hard rage
hitting fucking shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was just like my amped personality and I wanted music that like reflected that.
When you say that you were in high school and there was nobody else listening to the same stuff as you, did you have at least like one confidant, like best friend
where you guys were
growing together musically?
That's where I heard about the punk music.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, you know, maybe up until like the halfway through my sophomore year, or no, maybe it was like just after my sophomore year. There was this one kid in school who liked punk music too, but he was like 2 years ahead of me in school.
Yeah.
And but then we ended up having a health class together because, you know, then you could kind of get a mixture of different people, you know, from different grades in there.
Health class where they tell you like don't have sex without condoms or you'll die and don't
that
use
kind of
cocaine
stuff.
Because you'll get addicted.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that was our curriculum.
I think like we just had like a last, it was like last period health class. And like, you know, we were just like, we had our book bags and everything. And, you know, I had already had my Walkman like ready to go, like, uh-huh. so I can get on the bus. And, he was asking me what music I listened to. And then I think like his first, he was like looking through my CD book because we had CD books back then.
That was an iPod.
And, you know, and he's like, don't you listen to anything like before 2000? And I was like, not really. So on and so forth. And then he like burned me these two mix CDs, and one was like classic rock stuff, which I mean, I appreciated from afar, like, you know, the Beatles, The Who, and Creedence Clearwater Revival, and so on and so forth. And then the other CD was like punk songs. And my first reaction to the punk song CD was really negative, and I thought it was awful, and I thought the songs were too fast, and I thought all the songs were very badly recorded,
right.
and that the singers were terrible.
Yeah.
And I think the only song on the entire tape that I liked was the Dead Kennedys song, We've Got a Bigger Problem Now, which is just a rework of California Uber Alice, which you're familiar with that track?
No.
California Uber Alice is this track on Dead Kennedys' debut album.
Okay.
And it's a song about the governor of California. And, you know, it's kind of like a very tongue-in-cheek political satire song about him coming to power.
Uh-huh.
And the song We've Got a Bigger Problem Now is a response to the Reagan election. So mm-hmm. it's like pretty much the same song, same melody, same bass line, same everything.
Just Reagan.
Just the lyrics are changed about Reagan and the presidential election. But the thing about that song is that was a track that they recorded in, I believe, the same studio and I think the same sessions as all the songs on Dead Kennedy's album Plastic Surgery Disasters, and that song actually came off of an EP called In God We Trust Incorporated. And both of those, I mean, for punk records and just for rock records in general, both of those records are recorded fantastically, you know, especially even for 80s music. Like, you know, there are very few punk rock records from the 80s, and I think punk rock records in general, that like have as fast and as harsh and as aggressive and as colorful a sound as those two albums. Like uh-huh. the guitars are so brittle and bright, and the bass is so crunchy and just like really thick, and the drums, like the drum set sounds amazing.
And so that was the gateway drug.
Just hearing a very nice, cleanly recorded punk rock song was uh-huh. the gateway drug. But the thing is, like, I had already been listening to Green Day and Offspring, and I didn't
when I got like the derivatives of it, basically.
Yeah, but the thing is, when I was listening to that, that was just like rock for me. I didn't define it as punk. I didn't know what punk rock was,
right?
You know, and you know, that's another thing. Like, even though I had lived through a time when Nirvana was all over MTV,
we're at that age where it kind of missed us. I'm even being 4 years older than you. Like, I was almost a little too young to grasp Nirvana at the time. You know what I mean?
But still, even at the time, like,
I got how big they were, but it wasn't for me yet.
At the time when they were first coming out, I mean, yeah, you're right. I was too young when they were first coming out. But when I was first getting into MTV, you know, and they were still playing their videos.
Like Heart-Shaped Box and shit.
Yeah. I mean, they were still playing their videos, but it just didn't really resonate with me.
Same.
It wasn't until like my senior year of high school that I was like – that I bought Bleached, and then I bought In Utero, and then I bought Nevermind. And then I remember in college – when actually my pretentiousness reached new lows, and I actually ended up selling pretty much all of my nu metal CDs and as well as my Nirvana CDs like a total dick.
Yeah.
You know, and it's now into my mid-20s that I bought back my Marilyn Manson, my Antichrist Superstar.
Yeah.
I bought back my Nirvana CDs. And a few others too that I remember selling off.
Yeah.
Because I got really into singer-songwriters and I was like, this is the best.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like I got really into Tom Waits, who is the best.
Tom Waits is great.
But I remember at that time just sort of thinking like – because it was just like, you know, moment after moment after moment of me just kind of like having this extreme and just like thinking, okay, I found the shit.
Right.
You know, and then just like kind of casting off everything that I had been listening to previously,
right?
You know, because I remember, even though I didn't give up all my punk stuff at that point, I was listening to significantly less punk music sort of in that time. But I mean, you know, and I was getting into Bob Dylan and some Neil Young and, you know, stuff like that.
It's interesting that you say that, like getting rid of old stuff. And you also mentioned, like, you know, when you're 9, 10, 11, like music doesn't quite define you yet. But there is definitely a moment in your life where it feels like what you listen to defines at least partially who you are. You know, like you're either a rap kid or you're a punk kid or you're a metal kid or whatever. Like, how old were you before you felt like, I'm just a music kid?
When I felt like I was a music kid, I mean, that was definitely in college. That definitely happened in college, you know, and I was just like feeling like I was a music nerdy kind of person.
Yeah. The reason that I asked you about if you had like a confidant who you grew musically with is because mine was a kid named Josh Jansen. He was my best friend since fourth grade. And ever since we were kids, we were always kind of like these rebellious music listeners. Like, we stole his brother's Beastie Boys tape, like License to Ill, when we were in fourth grade.
Actually, Beastie Boys was a group that I was heavy into in high school, because that's when Intergalactic came out.
Intergalactic. And I mean, even the, you know, Check Your Head before that was amazing. Like, all, they have a great.
But still, that was like, that was before me. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And then from Intergalactic, I ended up getting into Ill Communication. Yeah. And then it wasn't actually until college that I actually ended up getting into Paul's Boutique and their earlier stuff. I actually think I got into License to Ill before I even picked up Paul's Boutique.
Yeah, License to Ill was very digestible for a fourth grader, because we just felt like we were badasses, because they were talking about pornos and cigarettes and they
were just
cursing
like crazy
on it.
Party music.
We were badasses. So as we grew up together, we were the kind of two kids that had weirder taste than everybody else. And so we were like early purveyors of the new metal shit and yada yada. But yeah, it's like with all that stuff, you go through this phase where you go, oh, I'm so embarrassed that I used to listen to this. And it took me a long time to realize, like, oh, I'm not a fucking punk kid, I'm not a metal kid, I'm not a rap kid, I'm just like a fucking music dork, you know? I just like music. Mm-hmm. You know? So yeah, you get to college, and what is it, you working at the radio station? Or
it's working at the radio station, because over there it was like there was just a lot of people who were into a lot of different things. And while I didn't really, you know, I went through my phases where I only wanted to listen to one certain thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I think during my last year in college, I had like one more credit left. It was like kind of one of those things. Like, I took a class that was like 4 credits instead of 5 or some bullshit. So I ended up like my very last year not being able to graduate because I had one credit that needed to be filled in. So I ended up taking a jazz class. You know, just like an entry level jazz class, and not like we're learning about jazz, like I'm playing bass in like a jazz ensemble. And part of the reason I was curious about it is because I had always been playing bass. I've been playing bass a lot of people would see me play and say I'm pretty proficient, but I didn't know how to walk. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew nothing about walking bass lines, and, you know, sort of the idea of the walking bass line just eluded me.
Right.
And whenever I would hear, you know, and not just in jazz, because I wasn't really listening to a lot of jazz at that point, but you know with bands like Aerosmith and a lot of the earlier classic rock bands and a few punk groups here and there, you know, I would hear a walking bass line in a song and I was like, what the fuck is that? How do they know what to play? How does that even make sense? And, you know, at the time, like, all I knew was traditional music theory, and my bass teacher at the time never taught me jazz, never really showed me anything jazzy remotely. I was playing mostly like blues and like 80s rock kind of stuff. And then there was one day when I'd gotten a hold of the bass books to the two first Rage Against the Machine albums. And then we sort of worked through all the songs on both of those. Uh-huh. And so, I mean, there wasn't like a lot of, and you know, and there are definitely approach notes that are played in those Rage songs. But that to me was something that like, that must work some kind of crazy music theory way that hasn't been like explained to me. And all I knew was like scales and chords and stuff like that.
Right.
So I didn't know exactly how walking bass lines worked and how you assemble them and what makes you want to play this note that's not in the scale at a certain time. So I wanted to take that class because that kind of eluded me. And then I remember through that, I ended up kind of getting into jazz because my teacher was telling me about all of these CDs that he had bought in the library. And then I remember I was like, for several weeks, like maybe 4 to 5 weeks, I was just grabbing like 15 or so CDs at a time and just like ripping them onto my computer.
Right.
And that's how my jazz collection started.
Yeah.
So, you know, I pirated, you know, upwards of like 45 or like 100 CDs or something.
Right.
You know, and, you know, and it was like John Coltrane, Miles Davis, Rashaan Roland Kirk, as well as like he was telling me a lot of bass players that I needed to listen to, like Jaco Pastorius, as well as Charles Mingus, Duke Ellington, Thelonious Monk. And, you know, and the thing is, that friend of mine who got me into punk music, he was also really heavy into jazz. That was just something that he didn't really show me because it wasn't something I really took interest in.
Yeah.
And then after that, I was able to ask him some stuff, and he was able to recommend me other things like Sonny Rollins and so on and so forth, and Art Blakey. And that's sort of where my jazz appreciation ended up coming from, sort of like really late into college, you know, just like the, I mean, he had big band stuff and I like some of that stuff and I like some of the early stuff, but my appreciation was mostly like that experimental 50s, 60s, 70s kind of ensemble stuff,
uh-huh.
The trios, the quartets and quintets. And sort of as I listened to more jazz, I ended up kind of gravitating more toward like a lot of the fusion stuff that happened in the 70s with Herbie Hancock, like
yep.
bringing rock and funk together with it, and Frank Zappa and Maha Vishnu Orchestra. Intermounting Flame is probably one of my favorite albums ever.
Uh-huh.
You know, not just like a rock or a pop out or a jazz album. I don't know if you've heard that record.
I've not.
But it's have you heard much Frank Zappa?
Yeah, I fuck with that.
I mean, Zappa. You know, like – Intermounting Flame is like pretty much all of the jazz rock stylings of Frank Zappa, but totally instrumental, minus all of the silliness
yeah.
and like super, super serious and hippy dippy.
Uh-huh.
And,
but just crazy time signatures and shit.
Crazy time signatures, super tight playing. I would actually say, you know, Frank Zappa was a really great composer. And
yeah.
while he had like really amazing solos on some of his records. And you know, I think him and the guy who played guitar in Maha Vishnu and fronted the band and spearheaded them, his name was John McLaughlin.
Mm-hmm.
He's still alive. He and Zappa were really on par in terms of chops, but John McLaughlin picked better musicians to play with him all the time.
Okay.
You know, they were really colorful to listen to and, you know, had better records too, because there were only a couple Maha Vishnu Orchestra records that were great.
Yeah. You get to college and you told me in the car, you were the manager of the radio station, right?
I was the music director for a year, and then I was the general manager for 2 years.
How did that happen?
I mean, it was just like applying for the job and just being around the radio station a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, just like any college club, there's like a certain level of apathy that everybody has.
Right.
And I mean, I was just like one of the few people that hung around all the time that just like gave a shit.
And you're just super passionate about it?
Yeah. You know, like just being, like I said, being around all these people that like music of different kinds that I didn't necessarily dig. You know, it's like I had that friend of mine who I still sort of keep in contact with today, who was like, even though we were talking about a lot of that hip hop stuff in the car that I wasn't crazy about
right.
then, like Game and Dipset and so on and so forth, he loved all that stuff. And like, you know, he sort of kept me in the loop to
uh-huh.
it to an extent. And, you know, there were people who were big into a lot of that pop punk Blink-182 shit.
Right.
There was one kid who had the most listened to show at the station, and it was an all Dave Matthews show.
Get out.
Yes.
That's funny.
Not only Dave Matthews, like
I could see
album,
Dave Matthews being huge in Connecticut.
He is huge in Connecticut. There was a stint of time where regardless of whether an album came out, he played every year.
Wow.
And it would just like nearly sell out. Not
yeah.
only because people were huge into his music, but it was a great place to buy drugs.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So, you know, and sort of do that. And
he's kind of became like a modern day Dead or something.
In a way, yeah.
Because they're jammy. They are jamming.
They are jammy live.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, Dave Matthews was really huge in Connecticut.
What was your show about when you had a show?
My show was just incredibly random, and me and my friend like just found great joy in just trying to play as many just like left field, nothing has anything to do with any other thing artists as possible, like play some Dead Milkmen and then play some like Art Blakey and like, you know, and then play some Stooges.
Yeah.
And, you know, and play some like Public Enemy.
So just like eclectic mixes.
It was just eclectic mixes.
Yeah. What year was this around?
This was like 2005, mm-hmm. 2006.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, that was the radio show that we used to do, and we called it Happy Fuzzy Fun Time.
What did you study in school? Was it accounting?
I was going to go into accounting in high school, but then I decided I wanted to work in radio. So when I went into college, I kind of did a liberal studies thing, and I studied three minors. I did political science, I did communications/broadcasting, and
mm-hmm.
I did journalism.
Okay.
So those are the three things that I did. You know, so I was just sort of taking my classes, general manager of the radio station, kind of picking up on some different bands and artists from people who went there. Like, you know, Tom Waits is how I got into Tom Waits because of the radio station. I remember it was around when he came out with that album Real Gone, which I think was like 2004.
Okay.
And, That's like his most distorted record.
My dad was huge into Tom Waits, and there are a few records that I've gotten into, but I've not delved into his whole extensive catalog.
So, I mean, you know, there were just like a lot of moments in college where, like you said, I just kind of discovered that I was into music more than anything and that I was appreciating, because even though people were like sort of specializing in certain things and knew more about certain things than I did, I just kind of saw myself gravitating toward a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Rather be a jack of all trades.
Yeah. You know, and then so I was the general manager for 2 years.
Did you start doing reviews on the radio station at all?
No.
Did you ever write reviews?
I never really wrote a review. I think also around this time, like, LiveJournal was popular.
Yeah.
And I had a friend of mine who turned me on to A Tribe Called Quest because she wrote like 3 paragraphs in her LiveJournal about who they were and left a link to download Low End Theory.
Yeah.
And so I was like, never heard of them before. I'm going to check this out. And then I loved it. And then
pivotal record.
I just thought it was like really cool that you could do that. And I thought, oh, okay, I'll try that. You know, so I think I did it like 3 or 4 times. I did one about Dead Kennedys and I did one about Dead Milkmen because those were like punk bands that I was listening to a lot at the time. But, you know, at that point I had already been turned on to music by so many different people. But that was the first time I guess I ever tried writing about it in a way. It actually like makes me wish I didn't delete my LiveJournal because I would love to see those posts.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, as far as the covering music thing formally, I mean, it really kind of started at the public radio station where I used to work, WNPR. I ended up getting an internship over there directly out of college because at that point I had kind of, through talking to people and just kind of researching my job, learned that, you know, unless I wanted to make myself miserable and listen to stuff I didn't like all day, I wasn't going to be a commercial music DJ.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I figured, and I already listened to NPR on a regular basis, so why not work for NPR and sort of do reporting? And that's what I was already studying. So, you know, I kind of went over there and I was shadowing some reporters and hanging around the morning show and helping out doing production and stuff like that. And it was a moment where the radio station went from being all classical to all talk, like within the span of a few months. It was like a nearly overnight change.
Wow.
And they were repeating a lot of programming at night. I decided that I would do a music show because I used to do a music show in my college years and, you know, like which just ended and I kind of missed doing that. So I was making some demos for a music show and I was giving them to the general manager. He liked them. So we started doing a podcast with that. And then I think maybe 6 months later, they were taking this half-hour show and they were airing it live. And although they weren't paying me for it or anything, you know, I just thought I was really psyched to air it. And the news director of the station, John Dankosky, and you know, George Goodrich, who was a production manager over there at the time, you know, who pushed me to do the show. But John told me you should do a website, you know, to sort of put the show on. And that's sort of when I started typing about music on a regular basis.
And was the needle drop the name of the site?
It was the name of the show. It was the name of the site. And that's when I first – I mean, honestly, that's when I first started like following Pitchfork, and not like in a sort of like I'm loving everything they're talking about kind of way, but it was like – sort of becoming cognizant of this online form of music journalism, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like Pitchfork started in like, I think the late 90s or something. And this is already like 2006, 2007.
Yeah.
So, I mean, while I dug deep about a lot of stuff, it was only through like hearing about things that my friends had listened to and sort of getting recommendations from other people who I know are into certain stuff. I was never like a huge rock magazine person or like a huge music website person. It was all just really like recommendations from friends and just kind of seeing other people's record collections.
It's interesting about sites like Pitchfork and sites like, and you know, folks like you, like though they don't cover just one genre, I almost feel like the amount of variance and the type of bands that they cover still encapsulate this one mega genre of what like people that are aware on the internet are listening. You know what I mean? Like, it's like the same people that are aware of Danny Brown are aware of Fleet Foxes or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like this big hip internet genre or something.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, there was you could be an artist who for the longest amount of time is sort of outside of that circle entirely. You know, Fleet Foxes is a group that because their debut EP was on Sub Pop Records, they were always in that circle.
Right.
There was never a point in their career where they weren't in that circle.
Right.
Whereas Danny Brown has all of this previously released material.
G-Unit and stuff like that.
Yeah. You know, and he has stuff like, you know, when he came out with The Hybrid and he sent it to me in an email and he was like...
I love The Hybrid, by the way.
The Hybrid is an album that did not end up growing on me until after I listened to Triple X and, you know, Triple X dug it. And I think Danny Brown said, like, he sent me an email with that album and I think he said, like, he said, like, one of the biggest turnoffs, like, for me to get me to review something. He's like, Pitchfork just reviewed my album. You should review it too.
Oh, yeah.
So I was just like...
I've heard that. The way to not get a blogger to blog about you is go like, oh, yeah, this blog, and this blog already wrote about me, because it's like, yo, you want to be the first. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's not even like you just want to be the first, but it's like... Is there, you know, give me a real reason to listen to you. You know what I mean? It's like, just because somebody else reviewed you doesn't necessarily mean I'm interested. You know, it's like,
I think what I was trying to say earlier about a mega genre is almost how what we were talking about, where at certain ages in your life, you feel like music defines you.
Yeah.
I feel like this younger generation that soak up a lot of music from the internet, it's almost like the way that they define themselves is by not being defined by any fucking genre, just being aware, you know what I mean, of all these different genres, and like getting to pick and choose the albums from those genres that they want is kind of this like definition of being aware about music now.
I mean, I think people are still defined. I just don't think they're being defined by a certain genre or anything like that. You know, it's like they're, like you said, they're and that mega genre you're talking about is just hipness in general.
Hip, exactly.
And you know, the thing is that's different now is that people are able to listen to so many different genres and not have to conform to what it is to be a rock person, what it is to be a hip hop person, what it is to be an electronic person. There are some people that conform to those lines, you know, and they only listen to hip hop and they only listen to rock. But it seems like that while maybe they are still in the majority, that there's definitely been an uptick of people who I listen to everything.
Right, exactly.
You know, it's like because those social barriers, because, you know, back in the day, as harsh as both genres were, punk kids didn't like fuck with metal kids.
Yeah,
you know
exactly.
what I mean? And like, even though there were plenty of bands out there like Suicidal Tendencies that like totally rode.
Yeah. Crisscross both routes.
Yeah. Crisscross both routes. You know, it's like there was still like animosity there. And
absolutely.
Punk music was punk music and metal music was
and
metal
music. And
it's
funny because when I was younger, I used to think when somebody would tell me, when I would say, what kind of music do you listen to? And they would say, oh, I listen to everything. I'd be like, that's a fucking cop out. Like, what's in your CD player right now?
Yeah.
Now when somebody says I listen to everything, I genuinely believe them because
sometimes,
I think
sometimes no.
Yeah.
Only if they follow it up with, you don't believe them if they say, I listen to everything but country and hip-hop.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Exactly. That's the most obnoxious answer that's been the same since the early 90s. I've been hearing that. Okay, let's briefly wrap this up about how you kind of became the fucking Anthony Fantano of the needle drop. Like, what was your first record review you put online?
I think the first record that I reviewed on the needle drop site was either A Hawk and a Hacksaw's album with a few Eastern block musicians. A Hawk and a Hacksaw is this band that features the drummer from Neutral Milk Hotel, and he plays like Eastern European music, klezmer, Balkan music, so on and so forth, which is a genre of music that I got into because the same teacher who was into jazz was big into klezmer, was big into Eastern block music because he himself was Jewish.
Was your format similar to what it is now when you put that video up? Or how long did it take you to come into that
similar, format? It was similar. I mean, the blog and me writing, it was similar in that I just kind of reviewed whatever I wanted, and sometimes, you know, something was really popular and kind of hip, like a Def Heaven record, for example. And then something was like not a lot of people were covering the Hawk and Hacksaw record because, you know, Eastern, you know, block music isn't really something that people.
It sounds like a very rare genre.
Yeah. I mean, it's like it's something that's from a totally another country and isn't hot. I mean, I think A Hawk and a Hacksaw got more press than they would have it during any other time, because during the moment that they were putting that record out, Beirut was hot, Man was hot, Gogo Bordello was hot.
Mm.
So you had all these bands that were borrowing from that genre of music in a very, very subtle way.
Yeah.
Like obviously they're all playing rock or indie pop or something like that very blatantly, but they're very subtly influenced by these Eastern European styles of folk music. I reviewed like Wolves in the Throne Room,
yeah.
You know, like that black metal band. I mean, I just sort of blogged and did my radio show since like late 2007,
yeah.
Blogged for a majority of 2008, and was still just not really making a lot of headway and was still working at the pizza place that I was working at.
When did you realize the power of YouTube?
I realized the power of YouTube.
It's a powerful fucking resource, man.
It's a powerful thing. Well, yeah. I mean, like I said, I was doing my That Is The Plan YouTube channel. Not like seriously or anything like that, but I was on YouTube all the time and I followed some YouTubers. And out of all the time that I had spent on YouTube and checking out bands that I liked, I'd never seen anybody talking about music on camera.
Right.
And I didn't have a lot of money for a fancy blog layout. Neither was it something that I felt like if I spent money on, it would just sort of change things overnight. Right. You know, like, hey, if I want my blog to be big, I got to put a whole bunch of money into it. Because I've always been like very frugal and like very afraid to like blow huge amounts of cash on something that I don't feel like is a sure thing.
So you just set up your fucking webcam and
I just bought like $100 flip cam. Yeah. And I just thought that I didn't think I was going to blow up on YouTube. I thought that if I did a video talking about a record, that I could put that up on my website and then people would go to the website and they would
watch the video,
see the video, and they would use that as like a way to separate.
So when
my
you started with YouTube, you didn't really realize what a social media network it was.
No,
I think a lot of people don't realize that YouTube is like a huge social media platform.
No, yeah. Because the thing is, when I was first putting my videos up on my site, I was using it just to be different from the other sites,
right?
Because at that time, I was fully conscious of Pitchfork and Stereo Gum and Gorilla Versus Bear and the 405 and Consequence of Sound and a number of other sites that at the time were some were and some still are just much bigger than what I'm doing.
So how long was it before you started grasping like, oh, subscribership and like, you know,
I think when I got like my first 100 subscribers, I was like,
wait a second,
you know? And the thing is at the time I was still getting, you know, a little more traffic on my website and getting more plays on my podcast than I was on my YouTube videos, but it was just sort of like in the matter of a few months, I got 100 subscribers. That's like, you know, that's more than I've gotten in a few months doing these other two things.
Yeah.
So let's just continue doing this. And then I think at the end of 2009, I had 1,000 subscribers, and that was like making maybe a video a month.
Uh-huh.
And I think the very first review I ever put up on YouTube was a review of Jay Retard's 2008 singles collection.
Uh-huh.
And, I was just doing a review a month. I did a review of Black Lips, 200 million thousand. I'm trying to remember other stuff that I reviewed because all those reviews are deleted now because I used to put song clips in them.
Oh, and then they get flagged and stuff.
Ended up getting me in trouble.
Right.
But then at the end of 2009, I had like 1,000 subscribers. I think at the end of 2010, I had 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was just like kind of significantly rolling from there.
Yeah, I feel like once you hit that first 10,000, it starts to get a little bit exponential, huh?
I mean, it's always been a very slow, gradual upward hike. But the thing is, as I go up, it's like the momentum keeps going faster.
Yeah,
but the thing is, I've seen channels get that but then do the exact opposite. You know, it's like there's no telling when you're just going to like, you know, go over the hill or go down.
I mean,
but then again, it's like the channels that I've seen do that you know, some of which I have fallen out of favor with, and I have my own personal reasons why I don't like it anymore. Maybe that's the same reason other people stop liking it. You know, but I mean, I feel like the best way to have continuation of popularity on YouTube is just to do something that is as good as you can possibly make it and just make it be something that you can do continuously.
Consistently. Every
you know,
week.
Like I can review records all the time. You know, the thing is, I guess there are some people who nobody makes a video planning on it to be a viral video.
Right.
And being around the YouTube space and meeting all the YouTube people that I have over the years, there are plenty of people that try to make viral shit.
Yeah.
And it just ends up falling flat on its face.
Well, and that's what I find so interesting about your channel is like you don't have any technically viral videos, but we've talked about like you have a shitload of subscribers compared to most channels, but you still would be called a quote unquote medium sized channel. You know what I mean? But you keep chugging away at it and like the consistency, it's made you a very influential person in the industry, I feel. And like, despite maybe like purely YouTubers being like, oh, that's not that many subscribers. Like, I don't know. Like, I think that people really respect your opinion. And I think that like some of your reviews are like events. You know what I mean? Like people are waiting to hear your review. And I find that so interesting. Whereas you probably are more influential on modern pop culture than somebody who might have like fucking, you know, 5 million subscribers. You know what I mean?
I mean, I'm definitely influential in certain circles.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But the thing is, I don't know. I feel like there are some YouTubers who – I mean, music is such a – especially some of the music that I review. It's such a cool thing.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's something that like people who are influential and in the know and are in power try to keep, you know, sort of tabs on in order to kind of – I don't know, have this self-reflection of themselves that like, you know, I'm still in it, you know, I'm still with it.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people who, you know, I feel like have that mentality and they give shit a pass even though the music is complete shit, but only because it's hot and it's cool now, you know. And the thing that's really sad and unfortunate about these days is that a lot of the artists who sort of come forward with that kind of thing, it's like – their sound is so based upon just – or their popularity is so based upon buzz and hype that as soon as people just sort of lose favor with it, they just like completely start ignoring it and they don't even acknowledge that it was bullshit to begin with and they just start listening to whoever's hot right now.
Right.
You know, because that turnover in the hype cycle nowadays in the internet age is so much faster than it used to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I mean, you know music is this really cool hip thing and, you know, and I get comments from like people who, you know, have much bigger websites than me and much huger YouTube channels than me because I'm commenting on some artist that, you know, they keep in touch with because they either enjoy their music or, you know, they're kind of just kind of seeing what the buzz is about. You know what I mean? You know, like one of my recent videos, the Tyler, the Creator, the Wolf album, like Ray William Johnson commented on it and just sort of like, good review as usual, bro.
Shout out to Ray William Johnson.
And then I think like 1,000 subscribers just like poured in like shortly after he left that comment.
Wow.
And, you know, like other people have left, you know, there have been moments where it's like, whoa, really cool people are like watching my shit. Like there's this have you heard of Young Fathers?
Yeah, I actually really like Young Fathers. Like, I actually was just watching your Nardwar interview before we got here to try and like not ask you any of the same shit that he did. And I saw you talking about the Young Fathers, and which is funny because we've had Sean from Anticon on the show before, and he signed them and loves them and is always telling me, you got to listen to me, you got to listen to me.
So, he, like either he or somebody else hit me up at Anticon saying, hey, we signed them because of you. But also like they got on a podcast that David Byrne does in his leisure time.
Yeah.
He's like, I think I heard this about the needle drop.
That's
you know,
awesome.
Like on his website. And
Well, and it's funny that you say that because like similarly, we were very flattered when you've commented on our YouTube videos and you know, the first time I think was on a Milo video. And then the way that you got on to the podcast today was because of commenting on like, I don't know, Kid Sister or Saul or something. So yeah, thank you for fucking being the busiest music nerd. It's very awesome to see people that are out there doing it, paying attention to what we're doing as well. That being said, I want to ask one last question and wrap it up. How the fuck do you find time to listen to this much music?
I was just talking about somebody at the YouTube space about that because we have to do a our YouTube channel, something that they recommend to us is to do a channel trailer, which is something that it's a video. It's a video on your front page that people see if
that
they're not subscribed.
Yeah. Right.
And it's just like, mine is this really shitty, like 30-second or 1-minute long video where it's like, hi everyone, I'm Anthony Fantano. Yeah. And I kind of do this thing.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I just always put our newest video as the trailer.
Well, I was talking to this guy named Marcus. And shout out to Marcus. I was talking to him about this idea for a channel trailer that I have, and it has to do with people asking me that question. And I just want to do a montage of shots of me with headphones on in the most inappropriate places because obviously the
answer – You're just at a funeral with headphones on?
Obviously the answer is that I'm listening all the time.
Yeah.
And I was like listening while driving at the movie theater talking with friends over dinner.
Yeah.
And he says, hey, we can do a time-lapse thing where like, you know, the sun comes up and the sun goes down.
Yeah.
And he's like – you'd have to sit in one spot for like 12 hours though. And I was like, oh, fuck.
It would be an awesome shot, but you'd end up with hemorrhoids afterwards, you know?
I might do it though.
Yeah, you should.
Might do it.
Why
not? To get a pillow down there.
Yeah, there you
go. Just kind of sit still.
Sit with a donut, and then the only movement will just be your hand switching to the next album or something. That'd be a great shot.
Yeah, he said I could just be either listening to something or I could be with my laptop. And he says, what's cool about it is you could actually be working.
Yeah,
and
there
then,
you go.
And then, you know.
No time can be a wasted day when you're listening to music because it's all part of your fucking career at this point.
Exactly. But I mean, you know, it's just like listening is my 9 to 5 and that's pretty much it. And I feel like, you know, part of it is like listening is something, you know, it's kind of like a muscle and you can flex it and you can grow it. And the thing is, like, reviewing is kind of the same thing, because, you know, when you're reviewing something, you're trying to deliver somebody the experience that you had while listening. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are certain things about that experience that are worth explaining. And there are certain things about that experience that aren't, you know, like some people ask me, like, what if you hate an album when you first listen to it, but then 5 minutes in you love it? What do you say? And then I, you know, what I say is, at that point, I love it. I just said I loved it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Unless there's kind of some, like, some kind of significant thing that changed my mind, or, you know, it was like a complete 180 or just like totally unexpected. You know, that's not really discussed. You know, it's just like, there are certain things that I'm looking for in the listening experience, you know, in terms of emotions that come out, in terms of lines or sort of melodies or lyrics or beats or grooves that hit me, or just what the general mood of the album is, because I'm trying to just sort of not only explain to people how I felt about it, but maybe sort of what they're getting into.
Right. If what they can look forward to
if they try it, and what they might overlook or miss if sort of they're listening to it sort of in the background or something like that.
Right.
You know,
how many spins do you give a record before you review it?
Depends on the record, you know, but the thing is, some records I've hated and I've given it a review off of a few spins. Some records I've loved and given it a review off of a few spins, merely because at that point, and this is really only stuff that I feel like I can do with artists that I'm the most familiar with, because I kind of know what to expect. I know their history, and, you know, I know their style, and, I sort of know what to look for and what to listen for. Mm-hmm. You know, I can kind of pick that out fast and I can pick it out easy. Mm-hmm. The records that end up having to require, you know, as long as I know if I like it or don't, how much I like it and how much I don't, and what about the record makes it appeal to me, then I go forward and I review it, you know, because the thing is, I can decide I've listened to something after the first listen, but that doesn't necessarily mean I remember everything off of the record that I like.
Are you taking notes as you listen the first time?
Yeah, sometimes yes, sometimes no, you know, depends on some records are just so like Swan's The Seer, for example, you know, that the album's like over an hour long and it's such a demanding long haul of a record that you really can't be doing anything else other than listening to the record if it's actually going to like leave an impact on you and you're going to remember anything that happens, because it's such a, if you listen to it in the background, it just sounds like one never ending moment of chaos,
right?
You know, but if you actually are paying attention, you see the different moments, because even though there are quiet moments, there are loud moments, the shifts and the growths and the, you know, ascents and descents and alterations that happen in the music are so either fast or very gradual and slow,
subtle,
that if you tune out for a minute, you don't know how it got to where it is now.
Right.
You know,
right.
There's some records like that, that I can't really be doing anything else other than listening, and I won't feel comfortable writing anything until I'm on like my third or fourth listen or something like that. I mean, what really impacts how many times I spin something is familiarity with the artist and how long the record may or may not be. I mean, if it's an artist that I'm familiar with and the record is like 30 minutes long, it couldn't be easier.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But if it's an artist that I've never heard of before in a genre where I don't love a lot of records, or I just don't know the history as well, and the record is like 2 hours long, it could never be harder.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, hey, man. This was a fucking long conversation that I feel like I could keep going for another 2 hours if
we wanted
to. It
could go on forever.
Yeah. I like to get the nerd out sometimes. The people can find you at The Needle Drop, right?
TheNeedleDrop.com, YouTube.com/TheNeedleDrop, Twitter.com/TheNeedleDrop, Facebook.com/TheNeedleDrop, TheNeedleDrop.WNPR@gmail.com.
Woo!
And that's it.
There you go. Anthony Fantano, thank you for coming in. I want to say that the first time you called on the phone, I said, hi, this is Lee. And you go, hi, this is Anthony Fantano. And I was waiting for you to go, the internet's busiest music nerd. Because, you know, there's absolutely no fronting. What you see on the YouTube channels is what you get in real life. And I love it, man. Thank you so much. I always look forward to your reviews and I appreciate your time. My name is Lee. You guys might know me as Intuition, and can follow us on Twitter at It's Intuition. Follow my man Ben Shim behind the boards at I Am Database. As a unit, we are at That's Kind of Neat, Facebook.com/Kind of Neat, YouTube.com/That's Kind of Neat, and find everything in a pretty package on kindofneat.net. Thank you guys for tuning in again. This was Anthony Fantano, and that was Kind of Neat.
Forever.